Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us this morning. Coming up on the show today, Mesa Mayor John Giles is in Washington to advocate for background checks on gun sales. We'll talk to him more about that. And we'll talk about the future of the Phoenix Art Museum as another top curator announces that she is out. We also want to welcome listeners in Yuma this morning on KAWC, which is now carrying the show. So hello, Yuma.
In a moment, we'll hear about the Arizona Republican Party deciding to opt out of the presidential preference primary in March. Meanwhile, the state Democratic Party will be holding a preference election in March, and independent voters want in. One-third of Arizona's registered voters are independents, and in Arizona, that designation or lack thereof means those voters can participate in primary elections by simply selecting one party's ballot. Easy. But that's not the case in presidential preference elections, which are only open to members of a specific party. If Arizona independents want to participate in the Democratic presidential preference election in March, they'd have to first change their party, and that has people across the political spectrum demanding change. Here's one perspective from Tim Castro with Independent Voters of Arizona.
Next year, Americans will go to the polls to elect or re-elect a president. We can all agree this is a critical election, one in which all voters should be able to participate at every level. However, here in the swing state of Arizona, independents, those who decline to register in a party, will be barred from voting in our presidential preference election. This is a little-known form of voter suppression. There are over 1.26 million independents across our state. Let me tell you a little bit about who we are. 40% of our voters in our Latino communities are independents. Over 50% of millennials are registered independent. And among Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, 49% are independents. These numbers illustrate the massive voice that is being silenced in the presidential preference election. We're part of a growing national community of voters who do not wish to join a political party, but who are stakeholders in our democracy. Although Arizona's independent voters are permitted to vote in all other federal, state, and local primaries, in March of 2020, they'll be barred from voting in the Arizona Democratic Party's presidential preference election. That means 34% of our state's electorate will not be permitted to vote in an election that our tax dollars pay for. This is simply unfair. The Arizona Republican Party has closed ranks behind President Trump and decided not to hold a primary. However, the Arizona Democratic Party will be holding a primary, and party leaders have the power and authority to open their presidential preference election so that independents can participate. They should exercise that power. It's time to stand up for a healthy and inclusive democracy for all Arizonans, regardless of party or non-party affiliation.
That's Tim Castro from Independent Voters for Arizona. There's more information at indys4az.org.
The Arizona Republican Party has decided to opt out of the presidential preference primary in March, meaning registered Republicans will not be able to cast a vote for any of President Trump's primary challengers. The Secretary of State's office received the formal notification from GOP Chair Kelly Ward on Monday, though Ward started down this path a long time ago. This certainly isn't the first time a state party has chosen not to hold a presidential preference election, but why has the GOP decided against one at this time? Republican political consultant Constantine Carrard joins us now to talk more about this. Constantine, good morning.
Good morning.
So, like I said there, this isn't the first time this has happened. When have we seen this before, and is that the justification for the Republican Party here choosing to go this way at this point?
Yeah, it's pretty standard here in Arizona when you have incumbents running for re-election. Bill Clinton in 1996 was running for re-election, and the Democrats canceled that primary. Republicans canceled the primary in 2004 when George W. Bush was running for re-election. The Democrats canceled it again in 2012 when Barack Obama was running for re-election. So it's pretty standard here in Arizona.
What's the goal here from the Republican Party? Is it just not to distract from the main candidate you're hoping to push forward here?
Now, it generally has to do with resources. These things come at a financial cost. And if the outcome really is in no kind of doubt, it's generally a poor use of resources, both government and party resources, you know, to conduct an election where everybody knows what's going to happen.
Constantine, this is a tough one for some folks. I mean, obviously, President Trump is extremely popular among Republicans, even with some controversy from some different camps. So this is a case where, in any way, does this restrict the voices of some who are party loyalists in the sense that some who might want to hear more from a Joe Walsh or a William Weld or a Mark Sanford? I guess I'm wondering, is there anything there that could create, and maybe it created this for Democrats in the past as well, when you don't really have an open forum, or is that too naive of me, not political enough?
No, I think it's a fair question. What we've seen in the past is there's always going to be somebody who doesn't like whoever the president is, even in their own party. The other candidates, of course, can still come to Arizona. They can still campaign. They can still talk to voters. They can still promote their message. And frankly, the folks that are running against President Trump at this point in time aren't seriously running for president. They are running for exposure, the platform, to raise their own profile. None of them actually expect to get the nomination. The party, however, still conducts state conventions. There are conventions in the counties and the legislative districts. So the process of electing delegates to the convention is still very much live. And if the anti-Trump factions or the Never Trump folks want to take a stand, they can still elect delegates to the convention through the convention process.
So what about voters in Arizona who might want to voice their support or vote for one of those challengers to the president? What do you say to them?
They can still do that. Of course, they should be getting involved through the delegate process, through the convention process. If you'll remember, in 2016, Donald Trump won the Arizona primary pretty handily, but Ted Cruz's folks won the state convention, and the delegates that went to the state convention, while they were bound to Trump on the first ballot, were largely Cruz supporters. So there's sort of a two-step process here in Arizona. The first step, which is the actual voting primary, is very much kind of a foregone conclusion, and that's what they're going to skip. But the rest of the process is still in place.
Constantine, one more quick one. It takes me back when we consider Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now Trump, where we have moving away from primaries in this case. It takes me back years ago to when George H.W. Bush went against Pat Buchanan, and Buchanan got almost 40%, I think, of the primary vote. Is that part of where this comes from? You just don't want to take a chance?
Not necessarily. When Barack Obama was running for re-election, he actually lost in, I think it was West Virginia. He lost to a fellow named Keith Judd, who at the time was actually doing 17 and a half years in prison for extortion in Texas. And Obama lost 41% of the vote in West Virginia. Then he lost 42% of the vote in North Carolina to an attorney who had won delegates in Louisiana that the DNC took away. Lost 42% in Arkansas to this fellow who picked up like another 17 delegates, which the DNC kind of took away. And so I think to a certain degree, you'll see certain gamesmanship, but every president, you know, can have a rough spot. H.W. Bush was a different story because he had broke the No New Tax pledge. There was some real dissension within the party. The Buchanan challenge was a very real, legitimate challenge. Nobody really considered any of the challengers to George W. or Barack Obama or Donald Trump legit folks who actually have a chance. And I think that's why a lot of state parties will just skip the primaries.
Okay. That is political consultant Constantine Carrard. Constantine, thank you.
You bet.
The Phoenix Art Museum underwent the most dramatic of personnel changes earlier this summer when director Amada Cruz left to take over as director and CEO of the Seattle Art Museum. Cruz's time in the Valley was controversial. She was brought in to make dramatic changes in diversity and fundraising, and some longtime supporters and volunteers were critical of her and what she implemented. Months after her departure, changes are still happening that are leaving holes in the museum's leadership. The latest is the resignation of Vanessa Davidson, curator of Latin American art. She's leaving for a position in Austin, Texas. Robert Pala of Phoenix New Times has chronicled what's been going on at Phoenix Art Museum and is with me. So, Robert, why is this latest departure by Vanessa Davidson significant? What does it tell us about what's going on at the museum?
At a really difficult time for the museum, they are losing the foundation that those curators provide.
Director Amada Cruz was given a lot of the blame, or at least when people were troubled by things that were happening there. So she has since left for Seattle. Why are people still leaving? Does this indicate something bigger going on at the museum we should know about?
We are experiencing the fallout of her having been there. This is not really about her leaving. I think it's easy to say that if you don't like the current president and you get him out of office, or he eventually leaves after a second term, that everything heals itself and we go back to being happy again. It's not true. And it certainly isn't true with this arts institution. So she's gone. But decisions that she made during the 4 years or 5 years that she was there are still playing out. People are leaving because the decisions, a couple of reasons, I think on the record, it's got to be because the decisions that were made while she was there are still in effect. And therefore, the curators and the staff are potentially unhappy about those rules and regulations. And the other thing is there were promotions and layoffs made just as she was leaving, which affected what's left of the staff of the museum. The chief curator, Gilbert Vicario, was promoted, and there were people in the institution who felt that that was not an appropriate choice. Probably they started looking elsewhere for work, if they hadn't already been looking for work elsewhere. I'm most worried about the fact that the curator of fashion has left. She was beloved, and she was well-regarded, and she brought in a great deal of revenue for the museum. And right now, that museum needs revenue. The other thing that's missing with her departure is, let's say you're not interested in Renoir or Matisse, you don't care about Phil Curtis, you're not interested in Asian art, but you might be interested in that dress that Liz Taylor wore in Butterfield 8. So you're going to go to the art museum to see a show of dresses or white dress shirts or whatever. It was a very different animal, and it was a very intelligent decision on the part of our museum to give the license to a fashion curator that was given to her. So she brought in crowds of people who didn't care about art, who probably had a really nice time and maybe thought, I think I'll come back to this place. I didn't even know it was here. And she is gone.
So all those things being said, how much rebuilding is there to be done? This is a major institution in Phoenix. You and I are both people who've spent most of our lives here. Where do they go from here? You know, there's the national search, international search for a new director. But what is the current state of this place as far as an institution goes, and as far as an institution goes in the city of Phoenix? Has it lost its importance? Is it losing importance? Does it need to regain its footing?
It absolutely needs to regain its footing. But this is not going to be a year's project. This is going to be a decade of recovery. The folks who are left, I can tell you, having worked with them as sources on the story, are not transparent. The other thing that's true is that the chief curator is not well regarded within the institution. So word on the street might well be, don't go work there because this guy doesn't know what he's doing. I haven't met him. I'm sure he's lovely. I'll bet you he has a great depth of knowledge germane to his job there. But I've interviewed dozens of people who really need for me to know how they feel about this guy, and there's no roses in any of these stories. So this is a huge undertaking to have one international search going on for one position at any arts institution. But right now they've got three. Now they've brought Shelley Cohn in. She was in retirement from the former director of the Commission on the Arts. They brought her in to mend fences. I think Shelley Cohn needs to start her temporary position with the Phoenix Art Museum by apologizing to the community on behalf of the Phoenix Art Museum. She needs to apologize to those hundreds of volunteers who were kicked to the curb and badly treated.
It's nice that she would get that responsibility.
Oh, man. But they brought her in, you know. And then she needs to apologize to pretty much anyone else who was harmed by this recent regime that gutted our museum. It's our museum, Steve. It's not Amada's or Jim Ballinger's. This is our institution. It's there so that we can go look at beautiful things, and it's in disarray.
Robert Pala, longtime contributor to KJZZ, and of course, Phoenix New Times. Robert, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Four Arizona mayors are in D.C. this week advocating for action on the Bipartisan Background Check Act of 2019 that would require universal background checks on gun purchasers. Cronkite News reported nearly 300 community leaders from across the country signed on to a letter calling on Senate leaders to return early from their five-week recess, during which three separate mass shootings occurred, and consider the bill. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has so far resisted calls for him to bring the bill to the floor, arguing President Trump wouldn't sign it anyway. But could this lobbying effort change that? Mesa Mayor John Giles is among those making a case for the bill, and he joins us now. Mayor Giles, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the details of this bill. What exactly would it do?
Well, several months ago, the House passed, in a bipartisan way, some gun legislation that talks about background checks, essentially closing the loopholes for gun shows and some private sales. It has sat, as you mentioned, for several months without the Senate taking it up. Given the recent horrific shootings, the U.S. Conference of Mayors did send a letter to Senator McConnell urging him to call the Senate back early if necessary, but to take the legislation up. And so today's the first day the Senate's back in. So a group of mayors, I was honored to be part of a group of mayors that's here meeting with both the White House and the leadership in the Senate, encouraging them to address the issue.
Yeah, yeah. Why mayors, Mayor Giles? Like, what is it about your position and the other mayors there that you think you can bring a unique perspective to this and maybe move the needle?
Well, you know, partisan politics has been probably the chief problem in this scenario. And mayors, I'm elected, I am a Republican and proud of that, but I'm elected as a nonpartisan mayor. And mayors generally, you'll find, are more interested in getting things done than in preventing other people from getting things done, which is kind of the scenario in partisan politics. So, and frankly, when these kind of catastrophes happen, it's the mayors and the local governments that are really left to deal with the horrific consequences. Mm-hmm. And so I've been there, for example, with the mayor of Parkland, Florida, and Dayton, Ohio, and well acquainted with Mayor Margo in El Paso. And, you know, these are when these horrific things happen, that they're very traumatic to communities, and city government is typically where the problem's addressed.
Is this something that you worry about, Mayor Giles, like in terms of this happening in your city and you being the one to answer the call?
Of course. I mean, a few days after the shooting in El Paso, I was on a phone call with Mayor Margo, and he indicated that, how horrific the impact was in El Paso. And then he said, and frankly, now I've got to go to 22 funerals. And that was a very sobering moment for me, thinking, you know, if it's not a matter of if, it's when in the United States right now. When literally we've had a couple of hundred mass shootings just this year. As far as meeting the definition of those types of shootings. So I think every elected official, particularly mayors, have got to be very sober and thoughtful about this issue and be asking, you know, what can we do to mitigate the likelihood of us having to deal with that kind of a tragedy in our communities.
Do you think that this effort by you and your fellow local leaders there has been well received? Are you starting to hear, like,
yes,
you feel like you're swaying some folks?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, this issue, we're all familiar with it, and there's a lot of steam, you know, following a shooting, and then it seems like it kind of subsides a little bit. But I can tell a real difference this time. I think the tipping point has occurred. This is going to continue to be on the top of people's agendas, certainly on mayors' agendas. And I think you're going to see Congress catching up to the public on this issue. We need the president. You know, the president has been kind of hot and cold on this. We need him to give the green light to Senator McConnell and the Senate, indicating that he'll sign legislation if it comes out. And I think if that happens, there's a real good chance we'll see some common sense gun legislation, some gun safety legislation coming out in this Congress.
All right. That's Mesa Mayor John Giles joining us from D.C. Mayor Giles, thank you again.
Thank you.
A new congressional candidate video is drawing lots of attention this morning.
I was an undercover CIA operative. My assignment was preventing rogue states and terrorists from getting nuclear weapons.
The video shows a woman driving a black Camaro going backwards on a southwestern dirt road.
Now I'm running for Congress because we're going backwards on national security, health care, and women's rights.
Then the car swings around to a stop, and the woman getting out is former CIA agent Valerie Plame. She's running for Congress in neighboring New Mexico.
And Mr. President, I've got a few scores to settle.
Plame is one of a growing number of women running for Congress. Here in Arizona, we have two female senators. In her new book, CJ and Wynn, The Inspiring Story of Women Changing Politics, Caitlin Moscatello chronicles the story of women seeking higher office, and she joins me now. Caitlin, how did what Hillary Clinton experienced in 2016 inspire more women to run, and how much of that was actually a reaction to Donald Trump and his behavior and his politics?
So it's really two things. So yes, I mean, women that I talked to in the 2 years of reporting this book, I talked to candidates across the country, and I would, of course, hear that Hillary Clinton had inspired them. But I think really what we saw was two things. So we saw women across the country watched Hillary Clinton, who was this incredibly qualified candidate, who had this long political resume. They saw her lose, and they saw her lose not just to any candidate. They saw her lose to someone with no political qualifications to speak of, who was known to many Americans as, you know, the star of The Apprentice, who had been caught on tape bragging about sexually assaulting women not too long before the election, and that he still won. So it wasn't just that, you know, Hillary had inspired them or that Hillary had lost and they were angry that she lost. It was also the fact that they watched this unqualified man win. They watched him take her place. And one of the things that has historically kept women off the ballot is this qualification barrier. Women, much more than men, will think, oh, I'm not qualified enough to run for office, or I have to have more experience, or I have to start smaller and work my way up. And that has really kept women from running. And seeing Donald Trump win, there was kind of this realization, this moment of, well, if that guy can be president of the United States, you know, surely I can run for my state legislature or for Congress or for city council or whatever the office may be.
So specifically the women that you profile in CJ and Wynn, there's such an authenticity to each of them. And I wonder, that word can be overused these days, but when it comes to women being able to be themselves as men are supposedly able to be themselves, how big a step was that for candidates in 2018? Do you think we'll see more of that style in 2020?
Coming off of 2016 and then looking at what we saw in the 2018 midterms, I mean, women had watched Hillary Clinton pretty much play by the maybe more traditional rule book, right? You know, who are we used to seeing in office? We're used to seeing older white men in office. White men still dominate our political system, and it's because they run for office more than anyone else. But I think that there did used to be more of a tendency, I think, for women to try to fit themselves into this traditional political mold or this mold of maybe what a candidate should be, which happened, you know, because there's just so many white men in office. That was the mold. And I think that really got thrown out the door after 2016. And so in the 2018 election cycle, women saw Hillary Clinton lose. And I think there was a little bit of this reaction of like, well, then I'm just going to put it on the table. Like, I'm just going to be myself. The stakes felt very, very high for the women that I spoke with who ran in the 2018 election cycle. And there was very much this feeling of, I'm just going to run who I am. I'm going to run as myself. I'm going to be true to who I am. And in that, you know, there's different examples of that. So we saw women who were talking really openly about their experiences as being, you know, mothers on the campaign trail, talking about affordable child care. There were women bringing young children to their campaign events when in other years they would have been encouraged not to. They, in the background, we had the Me Too movement, of course, going on during that election cycle. And there were female candidates who were openly talking about their own experiences with sexual assault, with sexual harassment. And not only were they talking about their experiences, but they were also creating policy to protect other women from those experiences and other girls from those experiences. The authenticity didn't feel forced, and it really, I think, did energize voters around them. Now, in terms of going forward in 2020, you know, a presidential race is always a different animal, and we really just don't have much to go off of in terms of women running for president, right? And so I think there have been some gaffes. Like, I think early on in her campaign, Elizabeth Warren, there was that whole drinking a beer thing, and some people didn't react to that. You know, they didn't necessarily think that was the most authentic thing. But I really do think she's very much found her groove as this professorial policy wonk, which is who she is. And she, I think, is leaning into that increasingly more.
So I live in a state in Arizona where it's been a number of years, but we had a run where the top five statewide office holders in Arizona were women. Both of our U.S. senators are women. But is there a difference in terms of whether people are generally, I mean, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, so I'm not downplaying that. But is there a feeling that more people are hesitant? They may say, well, okay, having a female governor, great. A female mayor, great. Oh, a president, I'm still struggling with that. Do you see that? And if so, why is that? Why does that still exist?
Yeah, well, I think the thing we have to remember, so unfortunately, we only have this one example of a woman being a major party nominee for president, right? We have this one person and this one election, which was a very unique election. That's all we're going off of. And so I do think it's unfortunate that right now there are reports, you know, that there's a lot of fear about, and I understand the stakes are, if you're a Democrat, you know, the stakes are very high for 2020. And so I do think that there is this fear of if Hillary Clinton didn't win, she won the popular vote, but she didn't win the election. So we can't risk that again. It's too high. Trump's running. We just have to put someone, anyone against him who's going to run. And kind of this tendency to think, okay, let's just revert back to what we used to do, which is kind of relying on, you know, I'm using air quotes, but the safe candidate who, you know, is sort of this more moderate white male candidate. And this idea of like, okay, well, independents or maybe more moderate Republicans might be pulled in by that. And that's how we'll win. I think that's a mistake. I think if we look at what we saw in 2018, we saw energy around women running for office, and not just women, but it was diverse women. And so I think what we should be doing is looking at where we are now. We should be looking at where the energy is within the Democratic Party. Who are the voters? What are the issues they care about? And not necessarily falling back on this, quite frankly, dated stereotype of who can win elections. Because the real fact of the matter is nobody knows.
Caitlin Moscatello is author of the new book, See Jane Win, The Inspiring Story of the Women Changing American Politics. Great to talk with you. Thanks for the time.
You too. Thank you so much.
Good morning. You're listening to the show. I'm Lauren Gilger along with Steve Goldstein, and we want to say a special hello to listeners at KAWC in Yuma and Parker. Thanks for joining us this morning on Colorado River Public Media. The trial of humanitarian aid worker Scott Warren captured headlines around the country earlier this summer. But despite the government's claim that Warren had illegally helped border crossers evade immigration authorities in Arizona's borderlands, his trial ended in a hung jury in June. As the trial played out, though, information about the investigation that led to his arrest was hard to come by, and a journalist with The Intercept hit a roadblock trying to get access to that information through the court. It was the perfect kind of public records case for the First Amendment Clinic at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. I sat down with Executive Director Greg Leslie to find out why the First Amendment Clinic got involved.
Well, we heard from reporters who just weren't getting access that they wanted to get. Initially, a reporter from The Intercept out of New York had been trying to report on the story and grab some documents off of the court's website. And then once he reported on them, heard that they were taken off the website, and that similar documents were no longer available either, that they had just decided to seal anything that was attached to a motion. And so that led to a bigger question of how is this sealing being done so automatically in these cases? And we learned that there was a page of requirements that you had to agree to as defense counsel, not the reporters even at all, but the defense counsel, in order to receive documents from the prosecution, had to sign an agreement saying we won't disclose them to anybody. And that shouldn't be allowed, but there was kind of a trade-off. The prosecutor was saying, look, some of these documents we only have to give you at the time of trial.
Right.
We'll give them to you earlier and unredacted if you agree not to disclose them to anybody. So for defense counsel, it's very tempting. It's a very tempting offer to say, let's get more information sooner and just sign this agreement saying, well, kind of keep it secret.
So is this common that the prosecution and the judge would allow this to happen and that the nondisclosure agreement was just accepted and nobody really thought about the press here?
As far as I'm aware, it's not common. Hmm. It shouldn't be common. A protective order for this kind of pretrial discovery material has to be created by a judge. You have to show the judge that there's good cause for such a protective order. So there is a standard. It's not an incredibly high standard because the idea is pretrial, parties are exchanging all kinds of information with each other. Mm-hmm. So there is going to be some privacy issues that come up. There are going to be other issues like that that need to be accounted for. So you're not quite as open with discovery as you are with other materials. But in the typical case, yes, you could go up to a defense counsel and say, could I see that document that the prosecutor gave you? And they should. They should turn it over. They should give it up, unless they're aware of certain special needs or considerations in a particular case.
Yeah.
Because these are documents that the government is going to use to prosecute somebody. You know, that's the fundamental government act that requires accountability. They're going to deprive somebody of liberty or property.
So what did you and the journalists involved in this think might be in these documents?
It was the defense counsel's entire argument for why charges should be dismissed. So they wanted to get these thrown out on various grounds. There were a number of motions to dismiss before the trial. Some of them were for improper prosecution, the improper investigation that they did of these activists beforehand.
Right.
The idea being that these guys were on the record saying, we oppose this. They had released reports. They mentioned Border Patrol tactics that they found to be improper and
right.
that they wanted to complain about. So that got them on the radar of the Border Patrol, and they knew they were being watched and followed. And so these documents that the prosecutors had already turned over showed the extent of that and showed what had happened, who they had interviewed to try to track these particular people, mm-hmm. more than just Scott Warren, other people, and just to see what they were up to. So it's, it wasn't anything earth-shattering. It wasn't anything illegal, but it just showed a pattern of how they were going after somebody, almost certainly because of the First Amendment-protected views they had already stated on the record through these reports.
Right.
So that became troubling, and they tried to get the case dismissed on those grounds, and that motion wasn't successful. But when you're making an argument like that, you have to attach the documents that justify your position. And they wanted to keep it all secret.
So that probably answers my next question, which is why you wanted to take the case.
Well, we wanted to take it because this is exactly what this clinic was set up to do. It's harder and harder for reporters to get information out of courts these days because in the typical case, and really I'm talking about the 99.9% of cases, there is no media there.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few reporters anymore who spend a lot of time at a courthouse. And so judges fall into this habit of allowing the parties to seal things or never even questioning it when something is sealed. And so this clinic was set up to help reporters who suddenly arrive at the courthouse and find they can't get access. We're set up to help them get access.
And the judge did ultimately decide in your favor. What do you think the importance of this fight over the First Amendment rights here signifies? Like in terms of the state of media today, like you say, there are not that many reporters in courts every day. So when we do need access for an issue that is, you know, of public interest, is it always there?
Yeah. So I think, you know, this case isn't going to fundamentally change anything, but it does kind of put that notice out there that things like this will be challenged. So it doesn't have that legal precedent that lawyers always hope for. And that usually only comes about if you take it up to the appellate court. And we didn't have to because we had received everything we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But it does kind of nonetheless put that notice out there that we're going to do this again if there is more court secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime we hear about it, hopefully we'll be able to get involved.
So everyone knows who to call.
Right.
All right. That's Greg Leslie, Executive Director of ASU's First Amendment Clinic. Greg, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
More than 30 million Americans have been diagnosed with diabetes, according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And many of those patients rely on insulin to control the disease. But insulin has to be refrigerated, and once opened is only good for a short time. So our next guest is trying to change that. Garrick Lindberg is an assistant professor of physical chemistry at NAU. He spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody.
It sounds as though, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it sounds as though you are trying to find a way to change the makeup of insulin to make it last longer, and especially once it's opened, right? I mean, is that a sort of a smaller version of what you're doing?
Yep, that's absolutely right. So insulin is insulin. It is a small protein that is crucial for the body dealing with blood sugar levels. What we are interested in doing is looking at the way that this insulin protein is actually stored and preserved when we think about transporting it to a patient that might need to use it. Currently, there is a proprietary way that insulin is stored. And the logistics of that mean that insulin has to be stored at a very tight temperature range in order to stay bioactive. So it has to stay between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius. And it also has a limited shelf life. So it'll last a few months if you don't open it. Once you open it, you really have to use it. A patient really has to use it pretty quickly.
So how do you try to change that? What about the protein can be manipulated maybe to make it so that it either doesn't have to be at that very specific temperature range or can last longer?
Yeah, so we're interested in taking kind of a totally new line of attack at this problem. And so there's a class of materials that have become popular in the last, they've really gained a lot of attention in the last decade or so, but they've been around for a few decades. These materials are called ionic liquids. And so ionic liquids are salts, just like regular table salt that we encounter every day, but they're made up of slightly different ions that cause them to behave a little bit differently. And so the key difference here is that they remain liquids at much lower temperatures than table salt. What's special about these is that they're so large that you can really manipulate what make up the ions and have them have very specific properties that allow you to do very specific things. And so in this case, what we're interested in doing is making insulin stay in the right shape in order to be bioactive. So scientists call this idea of protein shape folding. So we want it to stay folded the correct way. And then we also want to keep different insulin molecules from clumping together, because once they start clumping together, they're no longer bioactive and they won't do what we want them to do in the body.
How challenging is it to make it so that the folding happens and that you can keep the insulin at more of a room temperature kind of level and maybe have it last longer while also continuing to have the insulin do what it needs to do inside the body?
Yeah. So we are about a year into this study. It turns out that keeping insulin in the correct shape is not that difficult. What ends up being a little bit more difficult, though, is keeping it from clumping together. And so what we've been doing is looking for these salts that like to stick to the surface of insulin, so they block it from sticking to other insulin molecules, but they don't stick on too strong so that they can't come off when we eventually want to put it into the body.
That sounds like a very fine line you're trying to walk.
Absolutely. And so it is an interesting kind of fundamental physics question of just how do you get that careful balance so that the teeter-totter is kind of sitting in the middle and it doesn't tip over in the wrong direction.
Could this type of technique have implications for other medications besides just insulin?
It absolutely could. So we chose insulin because diabetes is so prevalent and it could have dramatic effects on the larger healthcare industry. And it could really help a lot of people that are struggling to deal with daily healthcare costs. But if you think about a lot of the medicines that we encounter, a lot of the healthcare technologies that we encounter, a lot of them need to be refrigerated or at least have very tight temperature controls associated with them. And so you can imagine any one of those taking this line of attack, designing an ionic liquid or a special liquid environment that is targeted for that material, and then improving the storage technology, the storage strategies around it. So one other idea that we've been developing related to this is looking at the storage of medicines that we think about launching into space. And so you can imagine astronauts encounter all of the same sorts of health concerns that we have down on Earth. But if you think about long-term space missions, not only could they potentially have an infection or something like that, but they're not going to be able to go to the pharmacy. So we need to be able to store medicines for much longer periods of time than typically medicines are designed for on Earth. And so we're looking at using these same sorts of strategies to design medicines to use in those environments.
It seems as though if you are able to do either or both of the things you're trying to do here, I would imagine that would have a fairly significant impact on the healthcare system overall, and especially patients who are treating diabetes, especially those who are reliant on insulin.
Absolutely. So if you look at the way that money is spent on healthcare in the United States right now, about $1 in $7 goes towards medical care associated with diabetes. And so if we can make it so that the medicines we produce last a little bit longer, that is going to make it a little bit cheaper to treat diabetes. And then the other part of this is that as we produce insulin, there's this idea of the cold chain. So we produce it and has to stay at the correct temperature to be active. And then as we transport it and store it, and then as the patient takes it home and uses it, it has to remain in this tight temperature window in order to be viable. And if we can relax that window just a little bit, we make it cheaper to transport it, but we also make it easier for the patient to deal with how they are actually going to use their medicine.
And when you talk about transporting insulin, I'm thinking especially that this would be helpful for folks in rural areas, maybe especially like up in your neck of the woods on Indian reservations, places that probably don't have a whole ton of pharmacies and aren't super close to major metro areas.
Yes. So Navajo Nation, 32% of the homes lack electricity. And then on top of that, electricity is just less reliable. So if we can make it so that the patients who are using these medicines are not so constrained by not having a refrigerator in order to keep their medicines viable, it's going to have a dramatic effect on the way that they are able to take their medicines.
All right. That's Garrick Lindberg, an assistant professor of physical chemistry at Northern Arizona University. Garrick, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
A longtime staple of Phoenix's downtown area may be going away, or at the very least, about to undergo dramatic changes. Earlier this summer, it was revealed that Union Station is going to be sold by Sprint, which has owned it since 2004. There are two communication towers at the South 4th Avenue location, one of which Sprint uses, and the other that is leased to Union Pacific Railroad. That agreement is scheduled to expire in 2023. To get some perspective on the impact of Union Station, we're going to go back in time a bit with Arizona's longtime official historian, Marshall Trimble. I met him recently at his office at Scottsdale Community College and began by asking about the first time he rode a train in Arizona and the impact Union Station had on him.
I was probably about 11 years old the first time. Okay. Kids could do that.
Sure, yeah.
My dad got a pass because he was an engineer for the Santa Fe, and that was the P-Vine, as they called it, because of the way it twisted through the canyons coming down here. And it was about a 200-mile trip. So it was a little longer than...
How long would that have taken?
All night, it seemed like, because we got on the train at night, and I just fell asleep in a chair, and it woke up the next morning, we were in Phoenix. So it was daylight. I know it was dark when I got on the train, and it was daylight when we got here, but it was a long drive, a long trip, because that is a funny thing about the P-Vine. When they built it, it was supposed to go, or there was one faction wanted it to go out through Mayer, and down where I-17 comes today, down through Black Canyon. That was the old Black Canyon Highway, which we also traveled a lot when it was a dirt road. Yeah, it was 196 miles by rail, but you went down to Prescott, and then you went way out to Skull Valley, out to Hillside, and then down around Date Creek and the Weaver Mountains, and then down past Congress, and that was the reason it went that way. Frank Murphy, who was one of the owners of the railroad, also owned a big mine in Congress. And so these people that wanted to build it the faster way, nope, it's going out there because it's going to go by my mine. We want a railroad there. So then it went to Wickenburg, from Wickenburg on in down, right, kind of down Grand Avenue, right down into Mobest and Phoenix.
How much a part of the flavor of sort of Arizona or connecting Arizona together had to do with train travel in those years? And then as a follow-up, because you know so much about this, what happened?
Railroads were the engines at that time that drove the whole America's economy. Mm-hmm. And this was before all the big 18-wheelers and the airplanes and FedEx trucks and everything like that. That's what made it so important to Phoenix, to have a railroad. To tell you the truth, the railroads, Steve, were trying to get rid of the passenger traffic. They just wanted to do freight. Okay. I say that coming from a railroad family. Passengers were a pain. Freight doesn't complain. So it was really during its time, but then I can still remember in the 1950s when people started flying, and especially with the jet engines and such, when the passenger planes had jet engines, then it was economical to fly. The airlines were making money hand over fist with the fuel efficiency with these jet planes versus the old turbine engines. And yeah, the writing was on the wall. The railroads really would like to get out. I think way back in the 1850s, 60s, when they were when the government commissioned them to build railroads, one of the deals were you have to provide passenger traffic too. You can't just make all your money with the freight. And so I think the railroad said, well, okay, I guess we will. And they did. But boy, they had some beautiful trains. We couldn't afford them, but I think we were limited to the California Limited, but there was the Sunset Limited, and they were all, and the Southern Pacific had theirs. But all these trains had, like the city of New Orleans, had these great names of trains. we don't affectionately name our airplanes.
No.
So a lot has been lost. And you know, I can every once in a while I can get a whiff of a smell of a train station, it's like their memories, or the inside of a passenger train car. There, and I can't even describe the smell. I was trying to describe it the other day to somebody. I can't, but it's something that's in my head, in my nostrils, and it does. I can still see those old stations and the ticket offices and all that stuff.
Yeah. There was a time when, if we talk about Union Station mm-hmm. in downtown Phoenix, you're talking. There was a time in the 40s, maybe 50s as well, where you had a dozen trains coming through and all sorts of passenger traffic. There yeah. must have been something to see.
During the post-World War II years and during World War II, there were 18 passenger trains a day coming into the Union Station.
Every day, wow.
18 trains.
Okay.
And this it began to taper off down into the 50s. When my dad first started, they were still using steam locomotives. So the first trains I rode on were steam locomotives. And I still love the sound of that locomotive whistle versus these diesels.
We're hearing so much about autonomous cars, you know, so the self-driving cars. And they're being driven all around Chandler and all around Scottsdale. Mm-hmm. It almost feels like, well, why wouldn't you just take a train as opposed to sitting yeah. in the backseat of a car? Like,
if there was one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. So I mean, there's irony in that for me.
Yeah.
The idea that, do you see any reason to think that the passenger train will come back to Phoenix?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think the railroads wouldn't want to be in it. It would have to be something. Well, Amtrak tried, and they, you know, in 1996 they pulled out of Phoenix.
Yeah, it's been that long. Yeah.
I figured it out. It was 70 years from the time they got the much wanted, the one they were pleading for. You know, the Arizona Republic newspaper on their masthead every day said, I forget the exact words, but it was, we need a mainline railroad to Phoenix.
Yeah.
Blah blah blah, and. Finally, in 1923, it was the beginning of it,
yeah.
and it took 3 years.
So 26 to 96, okay.
From 1926 to 1997, wow. 70 years, and that's all.
Marshall Trimble is the longtime official historian of Arizona.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.